Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Guillermo Amaral joins me. We're going to be talking about SQLite. From 8 years ago, we did a show. Now we're updating that. We're also going to be talking to Richard Hipp about his new thing, Fossil. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Guillermo Amaral. Episode 320, recorded January 7th, 2015. Fossil. This episode is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Are you looking to upgrade your IT skills or prepare for certification? IT Pro TV offers engaging and informative tutorials. Stream to your Roku, computer, or mobile device. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account, go to itprotv/floss and use the code FLOSS30. That's FLOSS30. Happy New Year, everyone. It's time for Floss Weekly. It's another Wednesday, so it's time for another show. I am Randall Schwartz, your host, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you, as often as I can, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and not being aware of it, projects you may have never heard of but now want to go download right after the show is over. I know I do that a lot on this show as well. Joining me this week is my friend Guillermo Amaral. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Randall.
And where are you speaking to us from?
Still in my Mexican bunker here, as you can see.
Hasn't been bombed or blown up by,
not yet. Not yet. Okay. Not yet. We're still waiting, though.
There's a few of them just down the street, I'm sure, but apparently not. So, yeah, and I'm in an unusual place. I was here back in July. I am in Anaheim and in my condo. I'm working with Neil Bauman this week on Insight Cruises stuff. And I can see the Matterhorn from here. I can see Space Mountain. So I am right next. I see the Disney fireworks every night. It's really kind of cool. I'm on the 14th floor of this. It's really far up here. It's kind of fun. And my bandwidth is a little challenged here. So if at some point I sound a little fuzzy, it's not actually me, it's the bandwidth. I'm gonna blame it on that. For those of you who are able to catch it, we had a wonderful time at the Brick House last week. I'll talk more about that at the end of the show, but we had the New Year's Eve celebration there and I had a blast, and I'm still recovering from that in a few ways. So we have a really great guest lined up, though. Just announced like a couple days ago, because we had to put everything together to make this happen, but we have Richard Hipp is going to join us. The Richard Hipp. You may know him from his shepherding and creating and continually developing the SQLite server, which many, many of you actually have, even if you don't know it. It's in all of your smartphones. It's in most operating systems, and really great. But we're not going to talk too much about SQLite. We're actually going to talk to him in a few minutes about the Fossil source code manager, which was developed actually to support the SQLite project, but has become a project all on its own. So really looking forward to this wonderful conversation we're about to have with him. We last had him on, and I had to go back to my notes, episode 26 of Floss Weekly, back in 2008. Can you believe we've been doing this show that long? Man, that's like, was it just like 7 years or something? I haven't looked at Fossil too much because, again, I want to be kind of naive about it so I can ask all the questions. I'm sort of a parody of my own audience, yes. Guillermo, what do you know about Fossil and SQLite?
Well, I've seen Fossil being used in SQLite, actually, but I've never worked with it myself. But SQLite, man, that thing really helped me out through college. I didn't need to install any Microsoft SQL servers or anything, so that helped me out a lot. And I use it a lot in my day-to-day work. So that's Qt uses SQLite for most of its stuff too. So that's great.
Very good.
I love that thing.
Well, obviously, we should be talking to the expert about these two projects, but just before we do that, I actually have something I want to talk about. We have a sponsored show again. This is really great. New sponsor, too. IT Pro TV is a video network dedicated exclusively to the world of information technology. Whether you're looking to jumpstart a career in IT or you're already working in the field, IT Pro TV supplements traditional learning methods in a fun and engaging way to maximize your learning and prepare you for certification. IT Pro TV offers hundreds of hours of content with 30 hours hours being added each week. Their library includes video courses on Apple, Microsoft, Cisco, and more, including A+, CCNA, Security+, MCSA, CISSP, and Linux+. Courses cover topics like network security, Linux, Windows, and OS X support for desktops, servers, and more. But IT doesn't have to be boring. IT Pro TV hosts tell engaging stories and share personal experiences, which increases your retention. Shows are streamed live and available on demand worldwide to your Roku, computer, or mobile device. You can also interact with hosts during the show and topic-specific web-based Q&As. If this looks and sounds familiar to you, it's because the guys behind IT Pro TV are huge fans of us at TWIT. They have over 10 years of experience in IT learning and were inspired by Leo to use the same studio setup and equipment that we do at TWIT. Even if you're already studying with a book or enrolled in a certification or technical degree program, this is a fantastic supplement to learn at your own pace and track your progress. Measure Up practice exams are also included with your subscription, and you're also going to get virtual machine sandbox lab environment for hands-on practice and learning with HTML5 support for any OS. You can get this all for one low monthly price, which includes daily updates and new features monthly. It's comparable to the cost of a study guide and much cheaper than going to IT Bootcamp. So check out itpro.tv/floss, F-L-O-S-S, to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications recognized by employers. You're going to get a free 7-day trial when you sign up using our offer code, which will allow you to check out their courses, live stream, and more. Subscriptions are normally $57 per month or $570 for the entire year, but we have a special offer because they're huge fans of TWIT. If you sign up now and use the code FLOSS30, F-L-O-S-S-30, you receive 30% off your subscription fee for the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. And once you reach your 13th month, they will reduce your subscription rate even further, bringing your cost down to $24.95 a month or $249 for the entire year. So that's itpro.tv/FLOSS. And use the code FLOSS30 to try it free for 7 days and save 30%. We really appreciate their sponsorship for this show. And now, without further ado, let's go ahead and bring on Richard Hipp. Welcome back to the show, Richard Hipp.
Hey, Randall. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, good to see you again. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Awesome, awesome. And you look good. You sound good. Everything looking good there. Let's actually start with an update on SQLite. You want to talk a little bit about the things that have changed, I guess, in 8 years?
Quite a few. there's been a lot of water under the bridge in 8 years. No, we work on it full time now. I think when I talked to you last time, I was still doing custom software development for people and as my day job. But now we've got a small team, and we devote full time to supporting SQLite. Mitchell Baker at Mozilla helped us set up the SQLite consortium, which several large companies contribute to that and provides funds for several developers to work full time on SQLite. It's been really good. We've really improved the product a lot in the last 8 years. Just in the last couple of years, we've been doing all these little micro optimizations. You know, a change here, a change there, that each individual change only makes it go 0.1% faster or even less, but they add up. And so we've actually gotten like 65% better performance over the past 2 years. Added lots of really cool features. We've got common table expressions, partial indices, all the features that you get in the great big servers now are available in SQLite. So,
for the 10% of my audience that's not actually familiar with what SQLite might be, can you sort of back up one step and say what this is and why I might use it?
Well, SQLite is it's an SQL database engine, but unlike Postgres or MySQL or SQL Server, it's not a client server. It's not designed to scale up. It's a small embedded library. It becomes part of your application, just links in and writes directly to disk. So it think of it not as a replacement for Postgres or Oracle, but as a replacement for FOpen. Instead of opening a file and writing your content out to a file on disk, you get to use SQL to do that. You open a database connection to SQLite, and it goes directly back and forth to disk. And so it's small and lightweight, less than 500 kilobytes in size for the whole library, writes directly to disk. Mm-hmm. The entire database fits in a single database, a single file on disk. So it gets used a lot for application file formats. There's a lot of programs out there where you do file save or file open, and it really just opens a connection to an SQLite database on disk. Mm-hmm. And it's also used a lot in devices, gadgets, smartphones, the Internet of Things. They love to, it's used. We got an email some time ago about, some company's building a smart oven and they've got SQLite in that. It's usually in your television set. But we're also used in a lot of things. You know, the new A350 somehow uses SQLite in the avionics. I'm not exactly sure how, but it's there.
Well, the thing I really liked about it is that, you know, I'm often testing, you know, new applications that need to talk to bigger databases like a Postgres installation or something like that. And what I liked is that SQLite was almost all of that. I actually haven't looked at it recently, so sorry if I'm not updated enough, but it's still sort of typeless columns, right? But it has a lot of everything else like transactions. Now you said CTE is in there. So I could actually run real database applications using SQLite. It's not just a structured file server.
Correct. It makes a great way for testing applications. And in fact, I think Ruby on Rails, if you install it, the default database engine they use is SQLite, and then you flip over to Postgres or MySQL when you go to deploy. So no, it does everything. The typing system, I like to call it. Some people call it weak typing. I think it's a purgative term. I don't like that term. I like to call it flexible typing. Think the difference between C++ and Python or JavaScript. You know, with JavaScript and Python, you can put whatever you want into the variable, whereas C++, you have to give it a specific type. And so SQLite is more like the scripting languages. SQLite really started as a Tickle extension. It's a Tickle extension that escaped into the wild, and mm-hmm. so it follows the flexible typing rules of the scripting languages like Tickle. But other than that, and it's completely compatible with the larger client server database engines in the sense that anything that runs on those will also typically run on SQLite. But SQLite has this additional flexibility. And so sometimes people will develop an application and they're using SQLite as they're prototyping, and then they push it out to Postgres or MySQL or MariaDB, and then suddenly they get some typing errors because those engines are a little bit stricter about type enforcement than SQLite. Sure. But other than that, they're usually pretty much compatible.
And one of the things that I also found amazing, and I think this has happened actually since the show that you and I chatted with, is there's ways to register Perl callbacks from the Perl interface to SQLite. So I actually wrote an application where somewhere in the middle it used a stored procedure that was written in Perl and came back to Perl for that part of it, and then went back to the SQL being executed.
Exactly. You can because it's running locally instead of on a server, that means that in your program you can register SQL functions that call out to your program code. We also have this thing called virtual tables. So you can register an object. You build an object or subclass an object that instead of looking at disk for the data, it looks into the memory data structures of your program. And so you can, if you have some complex data structure inside your program, you can expose that as an SQL table and do joins against it and that sort of thing.
Wow. Okay, well, we could spend all day talking about SQLite, but I'm really a lot more excited about Fossil. Why don't you give us the background of how Fossil got started and what its problem is solving?
Okay, well, Fossil is a version control system. I wrote it originally because as a replacement for CVS for controlling SQLite. This was back 8 or 9 years ago, back when everybody was still using CVS. This was back before Git. I wrote this wrapper around CVS called CVS Track, and mm-hmm. that inspired a much more popular thing called Track, which kind of linked into Subversion and provided bug reports and wiki. But we were using CBS Track on SQLite. I realized I needed something better. And so I started putting this this distributed version control system together based on ideas that I got from Monotone. Mm-hmm. And it went live in 2007 and started self-hosting. But it it's like Git in that it's distributed. Everybody has a complete copy of the repository, and you push and you pull. But it's also different in that it's designed more toward a tightly controlled, centralized projects like SQLite. SQLite's public domain. And because of that, we have to be very careful about who contributes to it. We cannot accept drive-by patches. Mm. We have to have detailed copyright release documents on file for everybody who contributes to it. Now, it's free for everybody to use, but it's not free for everybody to contribute to. I mean, they can make a copy and contribute for themselves, but they can't fold it back into the official release unless we have all this stuff in hand. So Fossil is geared more toward that sort of project where you have a small core team of developers, and but you also want integrated bug tracking and wiki and a blog, and but also gives you the distributed features like you have in Git. So Fossil is a standalone binary. You just download the executable in whatever operating system you want to use and put it in your path somewhere, and it's installed. And that standalone binary is both the local client and the server if you want to set up a host for it. It more than just version control, it has a lot of the features that you would normally find on a service like GitHub or SourceForge, where you've got bug tracking and lots of reports and an online web interface. I really set out with Fossil to make it DO-178B compliant. DO-178B is the FAA's spec on what you have to do for safety critical software in aviation. And I got turned on to this because of some people who are using SQLite and wanted to use it in avionics. And I got introduced to it. It's a really, really great process for really getting the quality of software up. And so we try and keep SQLite to DO-178B standards. And part of that is the conversion control. So Fossil is designed to meet the DO-178B version control standards. Really, it's sort of an add-on to CVS Track. And if you go back and look at the old historical CVS Track and compare the source code to Fossil, you'll actually see a lot of commonality there. It's sort of a follow-on to that. But instead of using CVS as the back-end storage engine, it uses a new custom designed distributed version control system.
So for people familiar with Git, which is again probably going to be the biggest comparison here, because you're saying distributed version control system, how would you distinguish Git from Fossil? I mean, it can I still do the same basic things of having like a whole entire repo on my own disk? Can I still do the branching and merging and stuff that Git is so well known for?
Yes, the branching and merging, branches are very lightweight. You do the same push and pull operations to go to different repositories like you would with Git. The big differences would be, well, one, Git is designed to support Linux kernel development, which is a massive effort with thousands of contributors. It's also GPL'd so that you get a lot of drive-by patches where people that you may not know just contribute code. And that's okay. That community embraces that. But Git is designed to support that, because with Git, when you pull, you specify, well, I just want to pull this one guy's branch, this one branch off of his repository. With Fossil, when you push and pull, you push and pull everything. So all of the developers see everybody else's code all the time. keeps everybody in sync. And that works great with small projects. It's preferred with small projects because that way everybody's sharing everything. That does not necessarily work so well with Linux kernel scale projects because Linux doesn't want to see the test branches for thousands of contributors. That's not helpful in that style. But for something like for most other projects, it is actually helpful to know what everybody else is doing all the time. Fossil also supports the distributed wiki, distributed bug tracking, so that I can be on an airplane disconnected from the internet, and I can enter new tickets, trouble tickets, and bug reports. I can make changes to trouble tickets and bug reports. And then when I reach my destination and get back on network, it automatically resynchronizes with what other people have been doing. It is very much like Git, and people have been using Git. We'll see a lot in common, but there's also some philosophical differences there in that we're geared more toward BSD-style projects as opposed to GPL-style projects. We find a lot of the people, a lot of our user base, well, really Fossil was not designed to be a general purpose version control system. It was designed specifically to support the needs of SQLite. And that other people find it useful is just a bonus. I mean, we're happy that other people find it useful, but they were using Git and it wasn't working for them for some reason. And they discovered Fossil and said, hey, this is what I need. This is what I want to do. And then they become very, shall we say, outspoken proponents of Fossil. Do you know how ex-smokers seem to be the most adamant about secondhand smoke? It's kind of the same way with ex-Git users who are now on Fossil. They're very enthusiastic about Fossil.
So who else is using Fossil right now? I like that reference, though. That's actually very, very true.
Fossil self-hosting, SQLite uses it. There are many big projects using it right now. The TickleTK project transitioned over to Fossil in 2011. They were on CVS at SourceForge, and then SourceForge had a big month-long outage in, I think it was February of 2011. And so the TickleTK developers, I'm a former TickleTK developer. They call me a member emeritus. That means I've been fired. But they decided to go with Fossil, and they use it. Jörg Sonnenberger over in Germany has been trying to get the NetBSD people to switch over to Fossil. That's still a contentious thing. NetBSD has such an incredibly massive repository and such long history that it pushes Fossil to its limits. And so I think there's some resistance there. And there's a lot of small projects, one or two or three people using it, but we don't have a big user community like you have with Git.
So what makes Fossil better suited for something like NetBSD in this case? You mentioned it's so huge, right? And in fact, I've worked in NetBSD before, and I can attest it is pretty big. But just do a log on there. It just never ends, right?
Go ahead.
Is there a specific way you would kind of port the history from CVS over to Fossil, or how would that work?
Jörg wrote some scripts that take a CVS repository and export it into Fossil directly. And it was the TickleTK project used those scripts that Jörg wrote in order to do their import. And so that works. It's available. Use a search engine to look for it. It's not on our website. We might have a link to it on our website. And that works well. The thing is that, right, the NetBSD repo is just really incredibly massive. When you do a checkout, it has to create 100,000 new files. And every time you do a commit, it has to check the timestamps on all 100,000 files. And that takes time. So commit takes several seconds to happen rather than being instantaneous. So there's a lot of reasons why you might be disappointed with the performance on a Fossil on a project that big. But for reasonable size projects of a few thousand files and only, say, 15 years of development history as opposed to 30, it works great. And it's fast and instantaneous and doesn't give any trouble. To be fair, we really appreciate Jörg's efforts because he's really stressed Fossil, and we've made a lot of significant performance improvements in Fossil based on their experiences with NetBSD.
A mere 15 years, huh? Yeah, that's just a tiny little project.
Right. Well, SQLite's 15 years old, so that's sort of our goal. We want to support 15-year-old projects.
So is there any other way somebody might find their way to start working for you guys, so like actually working as one of your developers there?
Yeah, for Fossil. Now, with SQLite, we're very particular about who joins the ranks of committers. There's a very small number of committers in SQLite. But for Fossil, it's wide open. It's a BSD-style license. So we do ask that people sign a copyright release that dedicates their contributions or releases their contributions to the code under the same BSD license as the rest of the code. But once we have that that copyright release here on file in my Fire Safe, which is just back over there, we have hundreds of committers to Fossil. About a dozen or so of those are active, but we welcome anybody who wants to contribute. It's really easy to contribute. It's all ANSI C code, ANSI C and SQLite. Oh, did I mention that the repository in Fossil is an SQLite database instead of in, say, Git or Mercurial, where the repository is a pile of files database. So we've got the power of a relational database behind Fossil, and that allows us to do a lot more interesting reporting. But it's also an interesting thing that so the SQLite source code is kept in Fossil, and Fossil uses SQLite as its repository format. So your listeners can ponder that recursion in their spare time.
So was there any specific need to go with ANSI C versus, let's say, something like C++?
I started in ANSI C because Fossil was sort of a follow-on to CVS Track, and CVS Track started in like 2002, and back then C++ was not nearly as pervasive as it is now, and so we kept going in that tradition. I actually, when I was prototyping Fossil, I worked in scripting language. I worked in Tickle because typically I see a tenfold productivity enhancement in a scripting language like Tickle or Python or Perl. But in my experiments, I wasn't seeing that with my Fossil prototypes. And so I just switched over to ANSI C because that allowed me to compile it down into a standalone binary that didn't depend on having an interpreter installed and so forth. And people ask me, well, why is that the case? And I finally came to realize that in Fossil, the scripting language is SQL. So we have SQL that does a lot of the heavy lifting of digging things out of the repository, and that works well. And then we also have just plain old ANSI C to do the low-level bit twiddling that you have to do for delta compression and computing diffs and all these kinds of things that also go into a version control system. So we kind of get the best of both worlds. You've got the full power of SQL to do the really complex things, and then you've got plain old ANSI C to do the low-level moving bits. And that's actually worked out very well. It was surprising, but it's a good combination. The benefits to the user are that you do get this standalone binary. It's a true cross-platform thing. Now, I know, like, Mercurial is another distributed version control system that's written in Python. And they say, well, we're cross-platform because Python is cross-platform. I'm going to argue that Mercurial is single platform and their platform is Python, and you just happen to have Python virtual machines that run on most computers. Whereas Fossil truly is cross-platform. You can compile it in binaries for Linux, BSDs, Mac, Windows, whatever you're running on. So we even have Fossil binaries on Android if you want to store a repository on your phone.
That's great. So for somebody like me, I mostly use Git a lot. I kind of worked into it from working at in the Linux kernel for a few years. But how would I, let's say, if I wanted to change over to Fossil and I want to get started with it right now, would I find every single thing I have in Git over in Fossil? Like, can I do pulls? Can I do pushes? Can I do do I have a staging area, stuff like that?
Yeah, most everything you have in Git is also available in Fossil. So if you wanted to just play with it, what you would do is just download a precompiled binary off the website, put it in your path somewhere, and then do a fast export from one of your existing Git repositories and pipe that into Fossil. And I think the command is import -- git or something like that. And that'll build you a Fossil repository that has everything that your old Git repository has in it. And then once you have that, you type Fossil space UI space the name of the repository, and that will bring up your preferred web browser, giving you a GitHub-like website that contains your repository in it, and then you can just explore and play around with it that way. Now, Fossil has all the same features that Git has, mostly. It doesn't have a staging area. We consider that an advantage, not a disadvantage. Most people we talk to find the staging area of Git to be very confusing. Certainly newcomers to Git find that very confusing. I know that power users can do some really interesting things with the staging area, but we have all the usual things like a stash, all the usual commands. The commands are slightly different, but all the same things are there: push and pull, clone, what else do you normally? Oh, diff, of course. But you also have Fossil goes beyond Git and gives you a lot of the features that you get with GitHub. Like I mentioned, if you do Fossil space UI, it starts up a little web browser, a web server there, and also automatically kicks off your preferred web browser and points it at that web server and allows you to surf around the project and look at old versions and look at diffs. It gives you a nice timeline down of all of your changes, and you can click on any two check-ins on this timeline, and it'll immediately give you a diff between those two check-ins, even if they're in different branches. Or you can browse backwards in time, going back to the beginning. I encourage people who are interested to visit the Fossil website, because the Fossil website is really just a running instance of Fossil on the self-hosting Fossil repository. So if click around on there and see what the capabilities are, and if you like it, you can clone the self-hosting Fossil repository. And when you do that, you don't just get the source code to Fossil, you get the entire Fossil website.
That's so pretty awesome, actually. We have a question actually from the chat room. I want to read this right away. Rourke's, whoever he really is or she really is, how are the individual revisions identified? In some sort of hash or something like the other DVCSs do?
It's the SHA-1 hash, the same as Monotone and Mercurial and Git. It's the SHA-1 hash, exactly. Now, any prefix of that hash will do. Any unique prefix will also serve. And you can also, if you want to go to a particular check-in, you can put tags on check-ins. And tags push and pull. And you can also specify that you want to go to a particular branch and just give the branch name and it'll go to the latest version of that branch. Branch names are global in Fossil, unlike in Git. With Git, the branch names are local. That's every individual has their own branch names. And so your head branch is different from somebody else's. But with Fossil, the branch names are global. It's part of the global namespace. So when two people are collaborating, they can use a branch name and say, hey, go to this branch, and they know they're both talking about the same thing.
Awesome, awesome. And just to clarify something we talked about earlier and touched on, and actually the chat room brought up again, you're talking – Fossil includes the built-in wiki, the built-in bug tracker. Are those also operating – in a distributed means as well? Can I, yes, at 30,000 feet, be able to update the wiki and see how it all merges back together? What happens to conflicts then?
Well, now with the wiki, right now it's set up to take the last edit wins. The data structure is capable of doing complete merges, and it keeps the complete history. So if you were on an airplane and you made an edit, and then somebody else made an edit, and then when you merged, your edit didn't appear because somebody else had overwritten it, then you could resolve that conflict manually. The data structure supports some kind of automatic merging of wiki. Just never have gotten around to implementing that in the user interface because it's never come up. But the tickets automatically they merge things together automatically, because every time somebody enters a change to a ticket, it's timestamped, and when it's computing the state of a trouble ticket or bug report, it just takes all of the changes in timestamp order, and so you can enter changes while you're on a plane at 30,000 feet, and then when you land, push that up, and other changes that have come in subsequent to that, they will get merged in automatically when it recomputes. So yes, the wiki and the ticketing and the blog features are all distributed the same as the source code is. What was the rest of the question? I'm sorry.
I think you pretty much covered that. I'm also curious though. You mentioned earlier that you're using essentially SQL as a scripting language. Does that mean I can write push hooks and things like that in SQL?
You can actually. Well, not directly. You have to. We have a language built in that's sort of a cut down version of Tickle, which we call TH1, and or you can opt at compile time to have full blown Tickle scripting in there, and then with that you can set push and pull hooks, which can invoke SQL to query the database all you want to, or you can just bring up the SQL database in third party applications and query things that are in the repository that way and do interesting reports like that.
That sounds really cool. So is there much of the internal code of Fossil written in SQL, or is it all written in C?
Well, the internal code is written in C, but it does a lot of SQL calls. Mm-hmm. And so that greatly reduces the size of the code base because all of the heavy lifting is in SQL. Actually, the number of lines of source code in Fossil and in Git is roughly the same last time I checked. But when I figure that, I'm also including all of the source code that implements SQLite, which is there's a copy in the Fossil source tree. So if you discount the Fossil, the SQLite source code, the Fossil source code is much smaller than Git because it doesn't have to have all the C code to dig down through the pile of files database that Git uses. Instead, it uses short little 5 or 10 or 20 line queries to extract the information that it needs. And this allows it to do a lot of queries that you can't really do in Git, in the sense that we can query, show me all check-in activity that occurred during the month of February in 2011, and it'll give you a timeline of just that interval, Whereas with Git, if you want to see a history of check-ins, you have to start with a particular branch now and then work your way backwards in time to 2011, because that's the way the it's structured on disk. They actually have to walk their check-in tree all the way back to wherever you want to look and figure it that way, whereas because we're in an SQL database, we have indices that will do that for us automatically.
If I like Fossil better than I like Git, which I'm still not convinced of yet, but I'll give you a chance to convince me a little bit more in a few minutes. But is there a way for me to do like what Git does with SVN, where I can have a local Git repo that's actually pushing and pulling to SVN? Could I do the same thing with Fossil and Git, or is it only a one-way import?
No. Well, with SVN, there's a guy he's over in Jerusalem. His name is Baruch Bernstein, I think, who's working on some really cool SVN import export capability as we speak. It's in a branch, but no, it's kind of a one way thing right now. You can import and export to Git, but there's not a way to really keep them in sync. Very well. Okay. There is an organization that has a Git mirror of the SQLite source tree on their site. I'll have to send you that link. I don't have it committed to memory, but they have a Git mirror of SQLite, and they're doing that somehow. So they're probably doing pulls and then pushing them with the fast import, fast export protocol of Git and moving them straight over. And that's a great way to compare the capabilities of the two systems. You can go and visit their website and look what they're doing with the SQLite source tree, and then visit the official SQLite source tree, which is running Fossil, and compare the capabilities of the two systems that way. That would be an interesting comparison, actually.
And something you brought up a few minutes ago, you said you have a copy of SQLite in the Fossil source tree. Does that mean you're maintaining SQLite in the Fossil source tree now, or are you constantly copying over the released versions back to Fossil?
Oh, we're constantly copying over the tip of trunk from SQLite into Fossil. We use Fossil as a test platform for SQLite, or one of many test platforms. So the version of SQLite that's in the version of Fossil that's on the official websites now is from 2 days ago. It's an alpha copy of SQLite 3.8.8, and that's a great way to really stress SQLite in a real-world application in advance of a release. You know how difficult it is to get people to beta test software?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's like pulling teeth. Nobody wants to do it. Everybody wants an official release. How do you get people to test it so that you find the problems before released, because nobody will, and then you push out a release and suddenly, oh, well, you broke my application. Well, how would we know? So
and
what
since,
we do
– Fossil is self-hosting. Do you ever have issues of maybe Fossil breaking its own repository?
Every now and then we'll have we'll be using Fossil, and we'll find a performance inefficiency in SQLite that way, which is a great way to find them and fix them before they get out in an official release. You know, you mentioned that a couple of years ago, we did have a repository go corrupt on us. It was the official Fossil repository, the self-hosting repository, got a corrupt database. And I said, oh, no, what is this about? So we went and we looked, and it turns out that S-Tunnel, which we're using to implement HTTPS, was launching the Fossil CGI, leaving the standard error file descriptor number 2. It was leaving it closed, and so then Fossil would crank up SQLite, and SQLite would then open its database using the first available file descriptor, which was now file descriptor number 2. And then there was some bug in Fossil, and it hit an assert. And the assert then wrote the assert error message out on file descriptor number 2, which was now pointing into the middle of the repository database. And so, you know, we looked at the corrupt database and saw an assert failed message in the middle of this binary. And so, okay, we know the problem now. So we used that as an opportunity to, it wasn't really a bug in SQLite. I guess you could say it was a bug in Fossil. It shouldn't have hit the assert, but still. But we used it as an opportunity to improve SQLite. SQLite is now careful to never open a database file with a file descriptor less than 3.
That'd be one way to solve that.
Yeah.
So I'm a heavy Git user. I've been involved with Git since the first month of the project. Been a contributor on one level or another on the mailing list for years, and I still use it for every project I can choose. Give me 3 reasons that I should change from Git to Fossil.
Well, you know, if you're happy with Git, I'm happy for you to keep using it. Honestly, I mean, really, I wrote SQLite. I wrote Fossil for SQLite, and if you find it useful, that's great. But I mean, some people, like I say, you run across people who, for some reason or another, just can't seem to get along, if you'll pardon the pun, with Git. It just doesn't work for them. I know that you had to have run across these people, Randall.
Many, yes.
And what we find is that a lot of these people, they work better with Fossil. But now, even if you're really happy with Git, and I'm glad that it's working well for you, I truly am, I want you to take some time to look at Fossil for a lot of the ideas that are there, because a lot of the ideas that I have in Fossil are not in Git, but I think that Git needs to steal them. Fossil is BSD code, Git is GPL, so you can just import the code directly. Steal my code, steal my ideas, and use them and make Git a better product.
What would you take from Fossil into Git?
All right, so Fossil has this all command. You can say Fossil all sync. And Fossil remembers all of the repositories that you have on your login. And I typically have dozens or hundreds of active projects going on in Fossil. And I'm working on my Ubuntu desktop right here, which is where mm-hmm. I normally work, mm-hmm. and I'm getting ready to go on a trip and use this laptop that I'm talking to you on. Over on my desktop, I'll type Fossil all push. And that pushes all the repositories up to various servers I have. And then I go to my laptop and say Fossil all pull. And that pulls them all down automatically, all in one command. And so then I go, I get on the airplane, I'm working, I'm remote, I make some changes. I get back to my office, Fossil all push, it pushes them back up to the servers, and then I Fossil all pull over on my desktop, and everything's automatically synchronized. I don't have to go through and do this separately for every single repository that I'm working with. Or at the end of the day, I can say Fossil all changes. And that shows me all of the uncommitted changes that I have on every single project that I'm working on. I forgot to do the commit on this thing I was doing over here on this other project, and it shows me right away. So just the all command is something that you could very quickly and easily add to Git that would enhance its value. As an example.
Yes, sounds great. Sounds great. Yes.
Go ahead.
We're almost out of time, so I want to make sure we got a couple more really interesting questions I want to make sure we get asked before before we run out of time. Is Fossil already pre-built in the standard package servers like for Debian and Red Hat and stuff? Or can I just say apt-get Fossil and have it? How do I get it?
I think they are pre-built in some of them. They're older releases. Look, just go to the Fossil website, and there's pre-built binaries for Linux, OpenBSD, Windows, and Mac. And there's a source tarball there. Just download it, the source tarball, and type, configure make, and it just builds. And just get the latest. And that's the easiest thing to do. It's a standalone binary. It's very easy to install. You just take this one executable, and you put it on your path somewhere, and it's installed. It's not like Git where you have – how many different executables is it now, Randall?
Something like 60, I think. Pretty close to that.
Yeah.
And,
Okay. With lots of dependencies. I mean, Fossil works in a change root jail all by itself. There are no external dependencies. Well, you know, assuming you compile with minus minus static. But yeah, it doesn't have any dependencies. It has everything you need. Oh. So it's easy to install.
That's wonderful. And the other thing also Guillermo keeps whispering in my ear, is there anything the equivalent of GitHub as a hosted service if I don't want to actually run it locally as a server?
Yeah, well, first of all, Fossil makes it really easy to set up your own little GitHub service if you have a web server already going. It's a two-line CGI script. But there is a site out there called Chisel, C-H, I'll have to spell it for you. I'll have to look up the spelling for you and get it to you. Chisel.com that provides free hosting of Fossil repositories. And they've got hundreds and hundreds of Fossil repositories there that people have put up.
Well, we could keep talking for another hour. There's so many other things I want to ask you, but is there anything we haven't covered that you want to make sure our audience is aware of before we have to wrap up?
No. My point about the Git users, just look at it and get the ideas and steal my code. Really, I've got no vested interest in this. I wrote Fossil specifically for SQLite, and if it's never used for anything else other than that, it has served its purpose. But if people can get some ideas and improve Git from it, I think that would be great. Or maybe this is a better solution for you. Just give it a try.
Sounds wonderful. And I have to ask my two standard questions because otherwise my audience will yell at me. They'll send me an email tomorrow saying, why did you ask the two standard questions? So what's your favorite scripting language? I actually may even know this, but go ahead.
Well, I'll have to say TickleTK because
Definitely. And it's quite nice that you said TK because I think TK and what was the other thing? The thing that can automatically script something, run commands under...
Don Lives Expect.
Tickle. No. Yeah, expect, yes. Expect and TK put Tickle on the map. I think without those two things, we might not have ever heard of Tickle. So glad that both of those exist. And your favorite text editor?
Oh, I wrote my own, of course. It's Emacs bindings. Emacs bindings is typically what I do.
Dr. Hibb, is there anything you haven't written of your own and forked in your own thing?
A few things. I really need to write a good email server. I haven't gotten to that yet.
And then we'll bring you back 8 years from now, and you'll talk about this new super secure mail server. Do you have your own copy of Linux? You got a forked version of that too, or?
No, I used to do that. I used to build my own hardware and compile my own kernels and all of that. But I've gotten lazy as I've gotten older, and I buy pre-built machines that come with Ubuntu pre-installed, and they arrive with the root password taped to the box, and I just plug them in and use them. So,
is the password root by any chance?
No, no.
I'm surprised you don't have your own version of the Raspberry Pi or the Arduino now, too.
Well, I don't have my own. I do use a BeagleBoard over here for testing SQLite on ARM. But no, I haven't built my own.
Well, it's been a real pleasure having you back on the show. We'll bring you back about every 8 years and talk about whatever you've done next. This has been a pleasure, sir. Thank you for
Thank
being
you
on the
for
show.
Having me. It's good talking to you.
Very good. That was Richard Hipp, the reinventor of the world. What do you think there, Guillermo?
Well, any man that writes his own text editor is, right up there. Well, he's a very interesting guy.
Yes, I'm very happy to have him back. So Fossil is interesting. I might actually have to check this out. I don't, like I said, I'm a pretty heavy Git user, but Fossil may have some really interesting things that might work for some of the people for whom Git sometimes gets a little complex. I know that I've gone into many, many organizations as a consultant, and if they're using Git, there's almost always like about one new piece of mail every week in the sort of the developer mailing list that says, hey, guess what? Git can do this too. And it's always surprising how many things I'm even learning from the exchanges going on there. And I'm usually also the source of some of those as well. But it sounds like Fossil is good for what it's designed for. And I do also appreciate the built-in wiki and web server and the bug tracker, because I know that integrating those at some of the locations I've been at has just been insane with Git. So I may actually see if there's opportunities in the upcoming for Fossil to be deployed. And I'm hoping that there's a Mac port of it automatically, or just, you know, import install or whatever. But if not, it sounds like it's just a simple source file or two to compile down, and we'll see how that all works. Anything else interesting there,
Jeremy? Well, I'm probably going to give it a good old try, because as you mentioned before, having a bug tracker and everything else with a Git is very, very hard to, you know, actually get it working correctly. Yeah. And then you have to do all these, you know, special commands like git push for something master branch or whatever. And yet it just gets really silly at times. So I'm probably just going to give it the old college try and see if that actually, fits for any of my projects.
Yeah. Sounds great. Well, great. So we don't have a lot on the upcoming guest list. I have sent out, I think, something like 30 pieces of email to try to fill Q1 already. We do have a couple of people who are almost certainly going to happen, and one of them may even be next week. The MARPA project, which is a fascinating project to me. MARPA is a Perl implementation of the Perl plus C implementation of the early parser, EARLEY, not just early in the morning. Well, this is early in the morning right now. The early parser is a fascinating one in that it can deal with ambiguous grammars, giving you all possible parsings if it ends up being ambiguous at the end. It sort of parses them all the possible implementations or possible parsings at once. So my friend Jeffrey Kegler took this and built a Perl implementation of that. But one of the two things that, there's two things that early didn't do very well, and that was left recursion, I believe, or right recursion, the left recursion, I think it is, and empty production rules on the right. So Jeffrey figured out a way, using somebody else's paper, we're talking about the early parser, implemented that in Perl. So we now have the fastest, most comprehensive parser and lecture system available in the world is now written in Perl, and I wish other people would copy it so I could use it in other languages. But Jeffrey himself is not coming on, but he's his head spokesman for the MARPA project is coming on to talk, and I believe that's going to be next week. The Docker people have emailed me again and said we will have Docker on the show, so I'm hoping that's going to be coming up in the next couple of weeks as well. We're just waiting for him to get the date knocked down. Again, a lot of other people on the short list. A lot of emails flew out because it's during the holidays and people don't respond very quickly in the holidays. But if you go to twit.tv/floss, which is the homepage for the show, you'll see our big list linked from there. And if there's some project that you want on this show and it's not listed there, please have the project leader email me, merlin@stonehenge.com, and I will try to get them on as quick as possible. Lots of empty slots in this part of the year right now. So we have a live chat. We took a couple questions from there. That's at live.twit.tv at 8:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays, mostly. Occasionally we tape out of sequence, but mostly it's coming on there. And so if you come there, you can watch the show while it's being taped live, see the behind-the-scenes stuff, and also get your questions brought into the show, just as if you were sitting here on one of our mics. Very cool. You can follow me, Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter. I'm also on Google Plus as Randall L. Schwartz. I post there frequently about things, including my new way of eating, my low-carb, high-fat, ketogenic diet eating. Lots of comments about that. I just want to say, New Year's Eve at the Brick House, if you didn't see it, I think almost all of it was recorded and is now up on the this live stream, not the live stream, what do they call it? The live specials feed on the Twit Network. Go check that out. I did a few things. I did a nice round table with Rene Ritchie, the Windows guy, and I think, well, somebody else, four of us. I can't remember what, I don't watch their shows. Sorry, guys, I don't watch your shows. I think you watch mine, though, so hi there, but I'm sorry, I can't remember everybody's name. That was like a good 30-minute discussion. We got into things like the recent security breaches and Edward Snowden and a bunch of other really good stuff. I'm kind of hoping we can do that probably, you know, every 6 months or maybe every 3 months or something. That'd be really, oh, Steve Gibson, right, that's right. Sorry, thanks chat room. Steve Gibson. Sorry, I completely forget my arch nemesis occasionally. So Paul Thoreau and Rene Ritchie. There we go. That was the other three people besides me. Hopefully we get that little roundtable going again. And Aaron and Newcomb and I did some stuff on gadgets. There, Arduino that he has and Raspberry Pi. I also trolled the audience. We didn't have anybody for the hour that Kazakhstan had their New Year's Eve, and so I got them to play the Borat Kazakhstan anthem for that particular hour. So that was great. Yes, so we got that to happen. That was my troll for the day, and I actually popped my head in on a few other things as well. So it was a lot of fun. I managed to make it 14 hours. Leo did a full 24 hours. Leo got his head shaven. He got a tattoo of a Twit logo on his hiney there. It was just great. And most of that, like I said, is in the stream already, so you can watch that in the playback. I'm going to be in Cuba in a few weeks, so I won't be hosting the show. I've got suitable guest hosts, as I often do when I have to go away. And I'm also, for those of you in the LA area, I will be at Scale in February at the Hilton Hotel. I think it's February 22nd through 24th or something like that. So it'll be great. Jeff Jarvis, not the other guys. Jeff Jarvis was here, not Paul Thoreau. Right. Yes, that's right. Jeff Jarvis, who actually got his head or his beard shaven. There was various goals for raising money for the UNICEF. And as the goals kept getting hit, weirder things kept happening during the day. So if you haven't checked that out, go check that out. It was a lot of fun. I hope I can do it next year. That's all I want to plug right now. Anything you want to plug here, Guillermo?
well, I guess people can find me on Twitter. That's at GAMARAL. Never write my own name, but at least not spell it. And I'm going to restart my YouTube channel this week now that I'm out of college. That means extra time. So expect podcasts and expect some videos out there soon. That's pretty much it. I didn't do anything fancy in New Year's besides, eat and drink. I didn't get a tattoo or anything.
And you'll be at Scale, right? Don't you usually come up to Scale?
I'll be at Scale. I was supposed to submit a talk, but I never actually got to it.
Uh-oh.
But I'll be there, just mingling around and saying hi to people. So I'll be around.
Yeah, well, we do have an inside connection to there, so maybe you can still submit the talk late and still get it on.
Oh, maybe. I'll see. I'll see. Yeah.
We'll get Gareth back on and he'll just automatically approve your talk, whatever it is. So it's been a great show. Unfortunately, we're out of time. So we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.